Well, to wrap up our series here on the Five Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and especially the Fifth Horseman briefing, I thought it would be useful to impose on an old friend of mine, a dear friend, a legend in his own time, John W. Walvoord. I've had the privilege of sharing some platforms with him in the past, and we also both participate in the annual pre-trib study group that meets once a year. And he is probably the most respected expert on eschatology, you know, in the community. He has written, edited, or contributed to 57 books, written 32 himself and contributed to another 25. He's chancellor of the Dallas Theological Seminary. In fact, he served as its second president from 1952 to 1986. In fact, he's been on its faculty for 50 years. And he's written, as I say, many books. The most recent prophecy books, one is called Every Prophecy of the Bible. It's all indexed and cross-referenced and interpreted literally and along with its fulfillment. It formerly was known as the Prophetic Knowledge Handbook, but it has been republished as under a new title, Every Prophecy of the Bible. He's also well known for his book called The Rapture Question and another book called The Millennial Kingdom. And he also edited Schaeffer's Systematic Theology, which is the basic foundation for the Dallas Theological Seminary. And he also is a co-editor of the best-selling Bible Knowledge Commentary, which is published in print form and is also available in the Logos Library and other sources. He holds two master's degrees, an MA and a master in theology from, and a doctor of theology degree from the Dallas Theological Seminary. He was awarded an honorary doctor of divinity degree from Wheaton College and an honorary doctor of letters degree from Liberty Baptist Seminary. And he was the editor of the Quarterly Bibliotheca Sacra from 1952 to 1985. And as I say, I've had the privilege of sharing a number of speaking platforms with him and delight at both his incredible knowledge of the scripture and his delightful sense of humor. And in fact, knowing him is one of the things that I will brag to my grandchildren about. To put it in context a little bit, we've been indulging in a sort of a special topical study that I, with my tongue partly in my cheek, I call the Five Horsemen of the Apocalypse. We announced this some time ago, and someone called our office and said, gee, doesn't Chuck know there are four Horsemen of the Apocalypse? And one of our gang said, well, at Koineos, we try to give you more for your money. So being facetious, of course, but obviously wanted to use Revelation 19 as sort of a tie-off of the study. And as we get into this, one of the things that I've been leaning on and I want our listeners to be aware of is your book, Every Prophecy of the Bible. And I think it's the only volume I'm aware of that attempts to literally go through every prophecy of the Bible and put it into context. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, there is somebody who's trying to put out a three-volume, but it hasn't been published yet. But as far as I know, it's the only book that does it.
I think our listeners should be aware of the fact that I've lived my Christian walk in awe of the Dallas Theological Seminary. I subscribed to your quarterly when I was in high school, which is back in the late 40s, early 50s. So that goes back a bit. But I don't think there's any seminary that holds a candle to Dallas. And so obviously I watch the publication with great interest. And I have to say very candidly, I've been very appreciative for the opportunities I've had to be with you personally on some of these tours. Now,
yes, well, I've enjoyed it too.
And I appreciate that. And now, one of the things as we get into the book of Revelation, I thought it would be a good place to start is just to hear some of your views as to the appropriate ways to interpret the book of Revelation. Should we start there?
Yes, I think that's very important because a lot of people plunge in without ever asking the question whether they're interpreting it right. Now, the important point in prophecy, and it's the major division, is to whether prophecy should be interpreted literally or non-literally. Now, there's a long history in the church, but in the church, the seminary there in Egypt in the 3rd century advanced the idea that you can't take the Bible literally. And this was devastating to prophecy because it destroyed what the early church believed about a literal future millennium. And it wasn't until Augustine, a bishop that lived in the 4th and 5th century in North Africa, that sort of redeemed the situation. And he said that the Bible should be interpreted normally, literally, and grammatically in all areas except prophecy. But then he proceeded to make a difference. He accepted a literal hell. He accepted a literal purgatory. He accepted a literal second coming, but somehow the millennium was not literal. There's never been an explanation as to why he singled that one subject of prophecy out and said it was not literal. And the proofs he offered are totally inadequate. The literal millennium is just as literal as anything else. But that's a question you have to settle first. Now, I faced this when I wrote my book, Every Prophecy of the Bible, published by Chariot Victor, and I dealt with all the prophecies from Genesis to Revelation. Now, there are thousands of prophecies, and there's so many interpretations. How in the world can you get any system that makes sense? I adopted a simple rule that where the normal sense of the words made sense, that I didn't seek any other sense. Now, we all agree that there are symbols in the Bible. When Christ says, I'm a beam, he's the light of the world, he didn't mean he was a beam of light. And when he said he was a door of the sheep, he didn't mean he was a slab of wood. And when it says, and it pictures him as a lamb slain, obviously he's not a lamb. We have to recognize that there are symbols, and Daniel and Ezekiel and Revelation particularly have symbols that need to be interpreted. But the Bible itself interprets 9 out of 10 of these symbols beyond any question as to what it means literally. For instance, the 7 facts of the horns of the beast in Daniel 7:7, for instance, are clearly declared to be kingdoms in verse 23. In other words, you don't have to guess at what the symbols mean. Now, I believe the only way you can make any sense out of the book of Revelation or any other prophetic book is to take it literally. If you don't, it opens the door to dozens of views that are contradictory, and there's been no agreement whatever as to what the Bible pictures non-literally. And I believe the only such system is. And I went through from Daniel, from Genesis to Revelation, and when I got through, I found that I hadn't contradicted myself. I had interpreted these prophecies in a normal, literal way, and it all fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. Now, the literal method is the only one that counts. Now, that's very important in chapter 19 of Revelation. Because in chapter 19, the question is this a literal second coming? There are some that are trying to put the second coming of Christ at 70 A.D. when Jerusalem is destroyed. And of course, it's ridiculous, and scholarship has risen up against this. First of all, the book of Revelation was probably written in 95, and it pictures a future second coming. And then all the major Orthodox creeds of the church, whether Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, or Protestant, all have a statement to the effect that Jesus Christ is coming again to judge the world. And these are written in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries and later. In other words, they all took the position that the second coming of Christ is future, and that is the standard position of the church. Now, the confusion in prophecy arises when they take other prophecies and take them non-literally, but they do take the second coming literally. And so when you approach the Revelation 19, it's very important to realize it's talking about a literal second coming of Christ from heaven to the earth. Now, there's also a very important point right in the first verse, the expression after these things. Up to chapter 18, we've had a presentation of the awful tribulation, including the great tribulation, the terrible destruction of most of the world in chapter 6 through chapter 18. Now it says, after this, from chapter 19 on, it is chronologically in order. And so the 20th chapter follows the 19th. The 21st and 22nd chapter follows the 20th. And that's very important because the amillennial view that is so popular that denies the future millennium tries to bring back the first coming of Christ in chapter 20 without any evidence at all. And the church creeds, all of them, unite to say that that's not the case, that the second coming of Christ is a future event and that there follows something that we call the millennial kingdom, and the Bible calls it that. And the early church was united in this up to the second century until this idea that prophecy was not literal was poisted on the church. So it's very important to realize, first of all, prophecy is literal. Second, Revelation 19 and following are in chronological order leading up to eternity.
It's amazing. It really is astonishing to realize that with all the divisions in the body of Christ, all the different views about so many things, that there's such a widespread teaching of amillennialism, where amillennialism would seem to be one of the easiest controversies to knock down from a biblical point of view. It amazes me that everywhere you go within the denominational church is that this amillennial view is so widely held. And that's really because of Augustine having embraced this allegorization way back then, isn't it?
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous if you take prophecy literally. Now, in chapter 20 of Revelation 4 to 6, it pictures the resurrection of the tribulation saints. These are people who were martyred in the year or two before the second coming, that last great tribulation. During that period, the world ruler martyred them. Mm-hmm. Now it says they live again. Now this is after the second coming. Several days after the second coming, there's a resurrection of the martyred dead of the tribulation. And it expressly says in these verses that they lived and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Now if words mean anything, it says that the second coming of Christ occurred. A few days later, these people were raised from the dead. And then third, that they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. It's an explicit statement of premillennialism and the fact the millennium follows the second coming. Now, it's amazing to me that competent scholars, people that we honor in many respects, come to these verses and say, oh, this is not talking about resurrection, it's talking about salvation. There's absolutely nothing in that passage about people getting saved. These are people who were saved, were martyred, and then resurrected. It's obviously a literal event, and if you accept those three verses, four to six, you have to be a premillennial person that holds that the millennium follows the second coming.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly, I see. Now, can you help me? We share the same view, but I may not be treating it adequately. You know, the rider of the first horse, that is the white horse, in Revelation chapter 6, first two verses, we've taken the view, and I believe, that this is a false Christ. This isn't Jesus Christ. Can you help me nail that one to the wall?
Yes, well, of course, it occurs before the seal judgments, before the trumpet judgments, and before the vial judgments. In other words, all the events of the tribulation follow it. And that's not what the second coming does. It's the millennium that follows. And, of course, it speaks of him going forth conquering. But Christ conquers the world, to be sure, in the second coming, but by a totally different context and method. And it's very clear in Revelation 19 that it follows the tribulation, not precedes it, as chapter 6, verse 1 does.
The last time we were together, you gave a talk that I had great fun listening to. You point out that there are 7 resurrections, as I recall.
Yes.
And that was, you know, many people talk about 2 resurrections, first and second resurrection from the scripture. But you've actually discerned actual 7 resurrections, did you not?
Yes.
Is it fair to ask you to say?
Oh, yes. The first resurrection was the resurrection of Christ, which is past.
Sure, of course.
Everybody agrees on that.
Uh-huh.
Matthew 25:27, and this fulfilled the type of a handful of grain at the beginning of harvest.
The sheaves.
That's the second resurrection. Uh-huh. The third resurrection is the rapture of the church. And that occurs, we believe, before the end time events, and that's the way it's always pictured in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Every time the rapture is mentioned, it's mentioned as an imminent event. The fourth resurrection is Revelation 11, the resurrection of the two witnesses that witnessed for 3.5 years. They're allowed to be killed, and then they're resurrected, and they're caught up to heaven. Now, the fifth and sixth resurrection have to do with the Old Testament saints being raised, Daniel 12, 1 and 2, and the martyred dead raised, Revelation 20, verses 4 to 6. And those are the fifth and sixth resurrection. We're not sure which is first, but they're about the same time. The seventh and final resurrection is that of the wicked in Revelation 20 at the close, at the end of the millennial kingdom. And they're cast into everlasting, they're taken out of Hades and cast into the lake of fire. And that's the final resurrection. Now, there's not one resurrection then, there's 7 of them.
The term second, this last resurrection, is a resurrection to judgment, to wrath, isn't it?
Yes. Now, it refers to the resurrection of the martyred dead as the first resurrection. It's not first in the sense of number one. It's like a housewife who says, I'm going to go downtown and shop, but first I'm going to put the dinner in the oven. In other words, it's not the first time she's done it, but it means in order there's 1, 2.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the resurrection of the wicked is 2, and the resurrection of the martyred dead is 1.
So it's
it's actually the fifth resurrection.
So it's really
It's not numbering the resurrection. It's simply saying before.
But the first 6 of these are, in a sense, all categorized within what you'd call that first resurrection, then, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And then, so it's the first and second is really like more a category than a chronology, isn't it?
Well, they're all first before the resurrection of the wicked.
Gotcha. I'm with you. Now, this fifth and sixth, this business of the Old Testament saints that Daniel talks about in the early verses of Daniel 12 is a point of confusion even among a lot of scholars, a lot of prophecy buffs. Let's go over that a little bit. When are the Old Testament saints resurrected?
Well, there's argument about that. I don't personally think that they're raised at the rapture, because it says in 1 Thessalonians 4 that the dead in Christ are raised. Now, that in Christ refers to the baptism of the Spirit. And the only saints that are baptized by the Spirit are those that live from Pentecost later. In other words, the Old Testament saints weren't baptized. But it does say categorically that they're going to be raised from the dead. But it puts the resurrection of the righteous and the resurrection of the wicked together. It doesn't recognize the thousand-year millennial kingdom. But the Bible frequently does that. They're both future, you see. The point is that it's a future event. It's itemized for future events. And we have to get the further enlightenment of the book of Revelation to understand that there's a resurrection of the Old Testament saints first, and then there's a resurrection of the wicked later.
Well, when do you see that happening then? Would that be at the end?
Right after the second coming. The Bible doesn't really pin it down, but I take it in as much as the martyred dead are raised a few days after the second coming. I take it the Old Testament saints are also raised at that time. Now, it's very interesting that on the day of the second coming, nobody is raised, no rapture occurs. Whatever occurs, occurs later.
That's interesting. Well, it's reasonable then the fifth and sixth could be together, couldn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I see. Because that's one of the things that caused a lot of confusion, because there's some that believe that the Old Testament saints won't be resurrected till the end of the thousand years, but there's really no basis for that, is there?
No.
Yeah, I see. Now, the other question I often get is has to do with the armies that accompany the Lord Jesus Christ as he makes his appearance. Because there's a handful of references that imply they're angels, and there's another handful of references that imply that it's us. And how do you see the armies that are accompanying him on his...
Maybe the armies of angels, but the point is that at the second coming, everybody in heaven comes back with Christ to the earth. We are Christians, we've been raptured, and we come back with Christ, obviously. The angels come back with Christ. The whole heavenly scene is transferred to the millennial kingdom.
Well, this leads to a whole other issue that I wanted to have you tutor me on. If we look at Zechariah 14, and obviously in verse 4 it talks about his feet shall be on the Mount of Olives on the one hand. We read in Isaiah 63, we get the impression that when he returns, he is engaged in battle in Bozrah on behalf of the remnant, which presumably have fled there from Judea in accordance with Christ's instructions in Matthew 24. The question is... Fuchtenbaum and some scholars say that he comes back first to fight that battle in Bozrah, and that the Mount of Olives event is a victory after that engagement. How do you reconcile?
Well, I think you have to let Zechariah 14 determine it, and also Revelation 19. When Christ comes back, there's no real battle. They call it the Battle of Armageddon. But all he does is speak the word, the sword out of his mouth, mm-hmm. and all the soldiers are instantly killed. They're not killed by the army from heaven. They're killed by the word of Christ. And, of course, Bozrah is a part of that, I take it. But I don't let a minor reference like that deter me from the major reference that's given in Revelation 14 and Zechariah 14.
But he does have a vesture dipped in blood. Whose
that's
blood?
Right.
Is that the blood of his enemies?
Yes, I take it so.
Uh-huh. So that is consistent with Isaiah 63 and being apparently blood splattered and so forth.
Well, you must remember that every reference doesn't give the whole story. You've got to put it together. And sometimes the Bible isn't entirely clear. But it's always not clear on something that doesn't make any difference to us. Everything we need to know is clear.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you. I just was, I've been fascinated with some of Arno Fruchtenbaum.
Well, I think he's all by himself on that. I don't think most Second Coming people take that as a way he does.
Uh-huh. Okay. Interesting. The other thing that troubles many of us as we try to be diligent with the chronology or the layout of the book of Revelation, and as a student, of course, of Daniel 9, the last four verses, and also the Lord's remarks in Matthew 24:15, we recognize from both Daniel and to Jesus that the abomination of desolation event is a very, very primary milestone in reconciling end-time prophecy on the one hand. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to be as clear as it should be in the book of Revelation. Where in the seals and the trumpets and the bowls and so forth, where do you see the abomination of desolation event in that sequence?
Well, personally, I take what is probably a minority view. I think the book of Revelation is primarily concerned with the Great Tribulation of 3.5 years. And I argued that in the book of Revelation and expected people to take me up and try to contradict me. Nobody did. And the reason is that in chapter 6 you have the man conquering the world, the Antichrist. Now that happens 3.5 years before the second coming, not before that. So it makes it clear that the events that follow in chapter 6 are the Great Tribulation, not the first half of that 7 years. In fact, the book of Revelation never talks about 7 years. It's always 42 months, 3.5 years, and it could be possible to have two such periods, but the book of Revelation itself never mentions 7 years. That comes out of Daniel 9:27.
Mm-hmm. No, that's interesting. That's interesting. Well, then that sort of would play into the hands of the mid-trib types, wouldn't it?
Well, I know, but there's no rapture there.
Mm-hmm. Except
there's no resurrection there.
Except the implication of...
You have to have a resurrection and a rapture of living people to have the rapture fulfilled. Now, there's only one rapture, and that's that of the church. There are seven resurrections.
No, I'm with you there. Now, if the rapture is implicit in Revelation 4, verse 1, as I think many of us sort of tend to presume for lots of reasons, that implies then that the events that are going on in heaven in chapter 4 and 5 would presumably be parallel in some sense, at least.
That'd be after the rapture.
After the rapture.
I take it that the 24 elders who already have crowns have been, that's the rapture, that's the church, and they've already been rewarded. Mm-hmm. Now the rest of the saints aren't rewarded till later.
Mm-hmm. I'm with you.
And I don't think they're angels. I think that the authorized version there is the better rendering of chapter 5, where it speaks of the angels, the 24 elders, that is, being bought by the blood of Christ.
Yes, no, we're together there, but that implies, in a sense, if all those events that are occurring on in 4 and 5 would be...
After the rapture.
After the rapture, and yet before the midweek, before the abomination of desolation.
Yes.
Yeah, so
well, there's a period, I think, of more than 7 years between the rapture and the second coming. You've got the 7 years of Daniel 9:27, mm-hmm. and before that, the Roman Empire has to be revived, and the Antichrist has to be revealed. And all of that, it takes place before the 7 years. Then the Antichrist makes the 7-year covenant. So you have a period of more than 7 years. Now, I don't think the Antichrist can be revealed until after the rapture. So you've got a period of more than 7 years between the rapture and the second coming. It knocks out the post-trib view. It knocks out the mid-trib view, the partial rapture view. All of them get thrown by one side because there's a literal rapture more than 7 years before the second coming.
Yeah, the 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, seems to be very clear that a prerequisite condition to this world leader even being revealed is the rapture. In other words, there's an interval of time between the time of the rapture and he's powerful enough to enforce that covenant. So that could be a significant period of time. Could be many years, couldn't it?
Yes. Well, see, false teachers came into Thessalonians after 1 Thessalonians was written, telling them that they were already in the day of the Lord. And that was mm-hmm. Paul contradicted that, of course, because in 1 Thessalonians 4, he has the rapture, 13 to 18, and 5:1, he has the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord begins as a time period at the rapture. Now, the events don't follow immediately. And you've got to distinguish between the day of the Lord beginning, as it does in 1 Thessalonians 5, and coming, as it does in 2 Thessalonians 2. The coming refers to events. And the Antichrist is going to be fully revealed 3.5 years before the second coming of Christ. But he's partially revealed before that. He's revealed when he makes that 7-year covenant in Daniel 9:27, and he's revealed when he conquers the 10 nations of the revived Roman Empire, which occurs even before Daniel 9:27. So he's partially revealed, but the final revelation comes when he claims to be God and allies himself to Satan, and that's the final confirmation who he is.
Well, this is raises another issue. In Daniel 9:27, the Hebrew, as I have been taught, is actually says he enforces a covenant rather than actually. You know, we always say he signs a treaty, but doesn't it actually indicate that he enforces the covenant? And I'm wondering, is that possible that what he's doing is enforcing, and taking credit for the Palestinian covenant, just a right to the land? Is that a fair inference?
Well, I never taken it that far, and I think the point is that he is the maker of the covenant. He's the enforcer of it, yes, but he also makes it. He's the ruler, that shall come mm-hmm. of Daniel 9:26, mm-hmm. and I take it that's the Antichrist.
No, I agree. No, we're together there. I was just wondering, I'm curious, you know, the covenant, I wonder if that is somehow tied to one of the classical unconditional covenants, one of the four unconditional covenants out of the Torah, and the reason Isaiah calls it a covenant with hell is because they're looking to him rather than God for their right to the land.
Could be. I've never made that connection, but it could be.
And I see, I've always also been, I'm just given to somewhat of a speculative nature, but the fact that the white horseman in Revelation chapter 6, verse 2, is carrying a bow fascinates me, because if I track down that Greek word, the only place it shows up in the Septuagint is as a token of the covenant with Noah. And I wonder if the bow, we always jump to the conclusion that the bow there represents a like a bow and arrow, in contrast to being a token of a covenant, which is, if I try to apply the law of first mention, so to speak, the bow suggests to me that it's a token of a covenant, obviously a different covenant, a different covenant maker. But my point is, that's why I'm curious if there isn't maybe a cryptic link between verse 2 of Revelation 6 and the making of the covenant of 927, but that's probably way out in the fringe here.
Well, the problem is that the covenant doesn't conquer the world. It's the ruler that does.
Yes.
And I've always taken the bow as without an arrow, and that symbolizes that the fact that he's going to win not by war, but by they're all capitulating to him.
And by peace he shall destroy many, according to
you. Yes.
Yes, exactly. I'm with you. No, I got you. That's interesting.
I think it comes by proclamation, and the whole world is too weak to fight him.
Well, the good news, I guess the other aspect of all of this, is that it's a waste of effort on any of our parts to even guess as to who he might be. You know, I'm fascinated how many prophecy videos and books and newsletters and whatever spend, I believe, waste their efforts trying to conjecture who he might be, because if I understand 2 Thessalonians 2 correctly, a prerequisite condition on his being revealed is that we're out of here.
Yes.
And so it's our focus obviously should be on the horsemen of Revelation 19, not any of the horsemen in Revelation 6.
That's right. And, well, actually, of course, the Antichrist, there's been all sorts of guesses, and so far they've all been wrong.
I sure hope so, because some of them are pretty colorful. It's hard for me to try to conduct this interview, John, because I've been a reasonably diligent student of your teachings, and so I can't find something to construct to bring out a controversy, because we're right in step. And I appreciate your patience in tutoring us here, because this is an exciting area. Do you see? We speak of it literally. One of the questions I get when I push that hard, people say, "Do you think Christ is really going to ride a white horse when he makes his appearance?"
Well, I'm a literalist, but I take it that the white horse is a symbol of victory, and I can't imagine white horses in heaven. So I take it that that's a pictorial picture of triumph, but actually that they don't ride literal horses.
Well, I have to share with you, John, in our lighter moments, we've shared some light things. My daughter happens to be a very, very animal-oriented person. And I mentioned to her one day, because you were talking about horses, she knows there's going to be horses in heaven because of Revelation 19. I says, yes, and not only that, we know there's going to be cats in heaven. And she turned to me and says, really, Dad? And I says, of course. Well, how do you know that? I says, where else would they get the strings for the harps? And she almost hit me.
So, well, there's a lot of jokes like that.
But in any case, the donkey of Zechariah 9 was literal. And so if possibly the white horse of Revelation 19, now it would be literal. Now, the horses in Revelation 6, the classical four horsemen, I've taken that to be really a metaphor or an idiom of a...
It's symbolic,
yeah,
yes.
Of a force or a tide of circumstance or whatever. The other subject that gets much talked about is the bride of Christ. Because from a number of passages, we take for granted, of course, that term is used of the church, as the virgin bride and so forth from Ephesians and elsewhere. And yet, when we look at Revelation 21, verse 2, it's described there, of course, as a city, or the city is described as a bride, let's put it that way. And at the same time, as we look at the details, the idiomatic details of that city, they're both Jewish and church. In other words, up until that point, there's, I think, obviously a very valid point to discern very clearly the differences in origin, mission, and destiny of the church in Israel. And yet, as we get to chapter 21, there seems to be a commingling of those idioms. Can you help me there?
Yes, well, the idea of marriage is used in the Bible to depict our relationship to God. Now, Israel in the Old Testament is pictured as a wife who has not been true to her husband, but who's going to be restored. And that's the symbolism that's used of Israel. Now, the church, by contrast, in 2 Corinthians 11:2, is spoken of as a bride, that is one that's not consummated in marriage. And we have to go back to the traditions of the time where in marriage, the parents of the bride of the groom would go to the parents of the bride and pay a dowry. Now, that was the legal wedding. The second stage is in Matthew 25, when the bridegroom claims his bride and takes her to the father's house. And the third view is the wedding feast, which follows. Now, that tradition is the background of our relationship to Christ. Now, we're already married to Christ. That's why it is spiritual adultery to love the world. But when Christ comes at the rapture, is the Christ claiming his virgin bride and taking her to heaven, to the Father's house. And the wedding feast follows. Now, I take it that in Revelation 19, it speaks of the wedding as still future. Well, that seems to indicate that it hasn't taken place in heaven up to the second coming of Christ. And so it may be fulfilled symbolically in the millennial kingdom. The Bible isn't clear on that point. But the problem of Revelation 21, where it refers to the city as a bride, obviously it's either a person or a city. It can't be both. And I take it that the city is beautiful like a bride. It's beautiful like a bride. But it actually is a city because it has walls, it has people, it has going in and out, and that wouldn't be characteristic of a bride. And so I don't think the term bride there is referring to the church. It's referring to the beauty of the city.
Interesting. Okay, I see. Now, the marriage supper of the Lamb is a passage that precedes the appearance of the Christ on the horse in Revelation 19.
That's right.
Does that imply that the marriage supper of the Lamb is before the second coming?
Well, that's the problem. And most people just assume, in fact, some commentators are very dogmatic, that it has to take place in heaven. But when you get to Revelation 19 and you're right up to the end of the tribulation and it hasn't occurred yet, it seems it implies that it's future. Now, the term marriage there, as you understand, is the wedding feast, not the marriage ceremony itself. There was no ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
It's the wedding feast.
Yes.
And
yes,
that occurs for some time after first and second phases of the wedding take place. So I take it that then they announce the second coming as if that has something to do with it. But the Bible itself doesn't pin it down. And again, I'm not too concerned. I know they have this picture of this infinite dining room table that extends out into infinity with people sitting down having a feast. Well, there's going to be multiplied millions of people, and I'm a literalist, but I must confess that the wedding feast can't be literal in the ordinary sense of the term. In other words, I don't think we're going to sit down for a dinner, whether it's in heaven or earth. But it will be fulfilled, I think, in the early phase of the millennial kingdom when all the saints up to that time enjoy the millennial kingdom, whether they're church, whether they're Israel, whether they're tribulation saints, or people that are still living in their natural bodies who survived the tribulation. They'll all be there. But the wedding feast, of course, has a primary relation to the church, but the others will be the guests.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to hear this NASA astronaut by the name of Sharon Bourdain. She gives talks mostly to women and so forth. She's a spokesman for NASA because she was the astronaut that happened to have a cold the day that she was replaced by her substitute, and the Challenger blew up, and which of course shook her up and so forth. But she gives talks to women, and she has a very amusing style. Because she's very, very energetic type of speaker, but she points out that all of us are worried about the tribulation, this, that, and the other thing. She says we should be focusing on the marriage supper of the Lamb. Very much she's talking to women. She says, our questions really should be, gee, do they serve seconds? Who's going to do the dishes? And gee, I wonder what I'm going to wear, and so forth.
It's hard to get steak up in heaven.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah, right. So she has this little patter she does. Of course, has the audience laughing because her whole point, of course, is what she's really saying is that we need to focus on that which is our destiny and not that which is we're going to leave behind.
Well, the wedding feast is only one phase, and the most important thing about heaven is the fact we'll be there in the presence of Christ with our loved ones. That's the important point.
Exactly, and I appreciate this a chance to get some of these questions that I get clarified. One of the questions I still keep getting from a lot of people is this: all these questions that really derive from Marv Rosenthal's book, the pre-wrath book. And now, obviously, the term pre-wrath, I think we all agree that the rapture is before the wrath of God, but the real issues that he raises are to me, confusing. Is that a fair comment to get into that?
Well, let's face it that no one ever came up with this theory until Marvin Rosenthal came along. If he's right, then everybody else preceding have been wrong. And that's a pretty big statement. And now the second thing, of course, is he holds that there was no wrath till chapter 16. Read chapter 6. And go through the concordance and see how often the word wrath occurs all the way through the book of Revelation. He just doesn't face it. Now, I can tell you the background. The publisher sent me the manuscript of his book before they published it and paid me for a review of it. and I reviewed it and said that he's very dogmatic throughout the whole book. There is not one case where he takes up an objection to his book, to his view, and answers it. He just dogmatically throws it aside. In other words, he hasn't faced the facts that the Bible does not teach a rapture at just in the middle of the Great Tribulation. In fact, there's no supporting evidence for it.
Mm-hmm. That's the basic issue. All that really also applies to those that hold to a mid-trib position, doesn't it?
Well, you can't hold a mid-trib position and hold to a literal interpretation of the Bible. You can't support anything but the pre-trib view if you take the tribulation, unless you take the tribulation non-literally. In other words, that's the problem. And they all have to spiritualize it. I don't care if they're post-trib, mid-trib, or partial rapture or what. They have to spiritualize what the Bible says about it, and they think that's wrong. Prophecy is literal, and the literal view leads to the pre-tribulation rapture view.
That's perhaps the key insight of this whole discussion, I think, is that one's eschatology really derives from one's hermeneutics. In other
words, that's right.
And if one takes the Bible seriously, in the literal sense, and not quarreling over figures of speech or metaphors, the point is, if one takes it seriously, then that leads one to what we classically call the pre-trib premillennial viewpoint. All these others, the whole list of all the other diversions, are in effect derived from allegorization or spiritualizing passages. Is that an accurate or fair summary?
Well, the point is that they say dogmatically you can't take prophecy literally. How much proof do they offer? Absolutely nothing. You take, for instance, the important passage in Genesis 12 where Abram said, unto thy seed will I give this land. They arbitrarily say it can't be land, it has to be heaven. And that's absolutely essential to the amillennial view. I've gone through the Old Testament and tracked out every reference to the word land. There isn't one case where it means heaven, even typically. It's always a promised land on earth, from the river Euphrates to the river Egypt. And that's what the Bible describes as a literal piece of real estate. In other words, they constantly are assuming you can't interpret prophecy literally, but they've never done their homework. And my book on every prophecy of the Bible, I did my homework. I went through all the prophecies, interpreted them literally, and they make sense and fit together. Non-literal interpretation doesn't have any system. There's no agreement among any of them as to the total indication of future events.
Mm-hmm. And that's the long and the short of it in terms of eschatology. And the other thought that has hit me as we wrestle with the whole church and the tribulation is that the whole issue of the rapture is almost more an issue of ecclesiology than eschatology, in the sense that if we really understand the church, its purpose, its mission, its destiny, and it causes us to recognize its distinctiveness from Israel. And that's the other problem that the mid-tribbers have, is that to recognize that the Daniel 70 weeks scope is definitive in verse 24 as focusing, it's a Jewish issue and not a church issue. And I think one of the most helpful things that I derive from many of the of your writings and the other Dallas materials is that to be alert to the distinctiveness of the church in contrast to Israel, not to fall into the trap of what's typically called today what, Reconstructionism, or in its various forms, that somehow there's a church. To me, the current doctrinal confusion occurs from two points of view: the amillennialism on the one hand, and also the attempts to infer, or I should say impute, the promises to Israel to the church, which is again another rampant presumption that we find in most churches.
Well, they like to take the blessings of Israel, but they never take the curses of Israel.
Exactly. Well, and
even the liberals don't accept that anymore, that Israel is that the church is Israel. It's very interesting. I heard a liberal denounce that view because they don't like the law with its killing people. They say that certainly isn't the church.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the problems I have as we travel and try to teach is that we obviously encounter people from, because we're non-denominational, we speak from all kinds of platforms, and it's of course one of the difficulties that immediately emerges is that so many people are attending churches that do not have a refined eschatology at all, and they gradually wake up to the fact that the backgrounds of some of the denominations are clearly amillennial. They clearly confuse Israel and the church. The vestiges of 19 centuries of confusion here.
Well, they just don't take the Bible literally. Now, the point is that 1 Corinthians 12:13 states that the church is formed by the baptism of the Spirit. And there's no baptism of the Spirit before Pentecost. So you can't have a church before Pentecost if you take that passage literally.
Well, indeed, but see what they tried to argue, and it's hard for me to argue this because I don't accept it either, but the argument is that, somehow Israel forfeited, by rejecting her Messiah, she forfeited these promises. Now, the problem, of course, is the four primary covenants are non-conditional and eternal, and so declared, and so they apparently trample that in terms of trying to apply the Davidic covenant. This whole business of David's throne. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Psalm 89 makes it very plain that David's throne is still future. And it's not the throne of Christ. In a sense, it's David's throne.
And that was reconfirmed to Mary. The issue is that's a political throne in Jerusalem. It's not a heavenly throne, is the point.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And yet, that's the other difficulty that these non-literal views have to grapple with. Is the literalism.
Well, they just ignore, for instance, Ezekiel 47 and 48 that describes the regathering of Israel at the second coming and the Holy Land being divided up for 12 tribes and each tribe is assigned a section of it. They just ignore that. And they ignore Jeremiah 30 and 31 that speaks of Christ coming back, the great tribulation, how Israel is going to be delivered out of it. They ignore Ezekiel 39, 25 and following that says that the second coming of Christ, that Israel is going to be regathered and put in their land. They don't answer those things. They ignore them.
Now, there are people, even like Fruchtenbaum, who tries to argue that the current regathering that we've observed climaxing in the real emergence of the state in 1948 is not the second regathering.
Well, I think there's a refinement there that a lot of Bible teachers haven't caught on to. You see, in Matthew 24:15, Christ declares that Israel, now back in the promised land in unbelief, is going to be driven out. He tells them to flee to the mountains or they'll be killed. And Zechariah 13:8 says that 2 out of 3 will be killed. Millions of Jews will be killed in the Holy Land. Now, when the final regathering takes place, it takes place at the second coming of Christ. Now, the reason for Israel being in the land today as a political state is you have to have them there in order to have the covenant of Daniel 9:27. You can't make a covenant with the people scattered all over the world. But it's very obvious that the people in Israel today are not going to inherit the land because they're not Christians. They have to be righteous Israel. And that, of course, is not going to be fulfilled till the end of the tribulation. So this isn't the final regathering, that's right. But as I understand, it's a literal regathering to the extent necessary to fulfill Daniel 9:27.
And yet it is a second regathering in the spirit of Isaiah 11.
Well, I'm not sure that second and third are good terms.
Okay, I was just thinking, he says when I regather.
It's a partial regathering today. Now, I see at the end of the tribulation, every Israelite's going to be regathered. That isn't true today.
That's what Isaiah 11, verse 11, is talking about, a total regathering then, isn't it?
Yes, well, the most important passage, I think, is Ezekiel 39, 25 and following, that states it very explicitly that every Israelite's going to be brought back. And then you go back to Ezekiel chapter 20, it says they're going to be regathered and the rebels are going to be purged out. All you'll have left is Jews that have accepted Christ.
And that obviously is part of the goal or the result, if you will, of the tribulation period. Then,
yes.
Yeah, so that would imply that Isaiah 11:11 really is referring in an extreme eschatological sense, not just in a regathering of the state of Israel as we've seen it in the last few decades.
Yes. See, now Israel not only has to be regathered, but they have to be revived spiritually, and they haven't had that yet.
Now, on another point, the placement of Ezekiel 38, Hal Lindsey tends to insert that right in the middle of the whole Armageddon scenario. There are others, Grant Jeffries and I admit myself and Chuck Smith and others, that see Ezekiel 38 as a precedent condition, not necessarily part of the Daniel 70-week scenarios. What's your view on the placement?
Well, Armageddon occurs when Israel's in tribulation, not at peace. Ezekiel 38 pictures Israel at relaxed and in peace and prosperous, and there's a sneak attack upon them. In other words, the context is totally different. In Ezekiel 38, the armies come to the north of Israel, and God intervenes with a series of disasters and wipes them out. There's no second coming there. They never get to Jerusalem. Now, in the Armageddon, they're fighting in Jerusalem, Zechariah 14, the very day of Christ's coming. They're all over Israel. They're over the whole area. But But in Ezekiel 38 and 39, they never get that far.
That's an interesting.
And there's a lot of people confused because they're two different wars, but they're separated by several years.
And yet, you still place that prior to the second coming, in contrast to this strange allusion of Gog and Magog in the final chapters of Revelation. I assume that's a whole second reoccurrence of some kind.
Well, Gog and Magog become a term referring to ruler and people, but Ezekiel 38 is when Israel's at peace, and I think it has to follow Daniel 9:27. In other words, it's after the rapture, and it follows the covenant of Daniel 9:27, which brings Israel to a temporary peace for 3.5 years. Then at the middle of that 7 years, of course, the Antichrist turns on them and they become persecuted. But I think that's the best explanation. Again, we come to the conclusion that this passage, while people differ on it, and I have my particular view on it, doesn't affect our hope at all.
Mm-hmm. The fact that in Ezekiel 38 that God is specifically doing it on behalf of my people Israel is another allusion that implies that it's post-rapture.
That's right.
And yet, obviously, it's prior to...
The church is not there.
Mm-hmm. And so, to the extent, that's what makes it interesting, to the extent that it seems like the Ezekiel 38 circumstances are being pushed into place, that just implies the rapture's that much sooner. Let me put you on the spot a little bit of a minute. What's your, just a feeling, this is not a textual question or a scriptural question, but what's your feeling about the rapture? Do you feel it's close or do you feel that there's a lot to happen?
Yes, I think it could occur today. I think it's always been that way, but we have several reasons for believing it's close. First of all, the Bible never gives us a sign of the rapture. There's no signs ever given. But it does describe in detail the situation in the world at the time. And the situation in the world at the time is that Israel is back in the land. Well, that's only been true since 48. And it tells us there's going to be a world government. Well, United Nations isn't the predicted form, but it's conditioning the world to accept a world ruler when it comes as the way out for world chaos. And then in Revelation 17, you have the world church movement. A woman on a scarlet-colored beast. The beast represents the 10 nations of the Roman Empire, and the woman represents the church. They work together for world domination. Then 3.5 years before the second coming, the 10 kings turn on the woman, burn her with fire, because in the last 3.5 years, it's the worship of Satan and the worship of the Antichrist, not even any semblance of church. And that's what fulfills that. And so I take it that all of that's going to be fulfilled and run its course. But then on top of all that, we have the picture that the rapture occurs somewhere in the context the Roman Empire is revived. Well, in Europe, for 300 years at least, they've been fighting each other. They finish one war and they start arming for the next. Suddenly now in World War II, they didn't arm. Why not? Because they had the atomic weapon, and any time a war would break out, any one of the European nations could annihilate the other. And so it didn't pay to have a war, so they have the economic union instead. But even the secular world is saying it's only a matter of time until they have political union. They're trying to have a common currency. They're trying to have common laws. They're taking down all barriers of taxes and so on. In other words, the situation is all set up, and the secular world is predicting there will be a United States of Europe. Well, that's precisely what the Bible predicts for the revived Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. So all these things fit together. They've all come into focus in the last 50, 60 years. I think God's trying to tell us something because the nations, Israel, and the church are the three major areas of prophecy in the Bible.
So we're not being extremist if we look day to day.
That's right.
For our blessed hope.
It's always been possible, but now there's some evidence. And this situation isn't going to stay this way. We have a window here, perhaps for 10, 20, 30 years. We don't know when this will be true. If it starts changing, then it would no longer correspond to what the Bible pictures for the rapture.
So as long as this is the trends in front of our nose, it gives us a valid case to say, look up, for our redemption draweth nigh. Huh?
Well, there's more movement towards setting the stage for the rapture in the last 60 years than there was in the preceding 1900 years. Do you realize that?
That's quite a statement. It's true.
God's trying to tell us something. Wake up.
Well, John, I sure appreciate your allowing me to impose on you to sort of cover this review. The difficulty in asking questions is I can't find places that there's a disparity between the kinds of things you've taught us and...
Well, we have to agree on a lot of things because we agree on the Bible.
And of course, indeed. Well, and of course, Charles Kettering once made the remark, where two people agree, one is unnecessary. And I feel very unnecessary right now, John. And I wanted to just tell you how grateful we are for your teaching. Over the years, you've just been a pillar. I don't think there's any serious student of prophecy that hasn't benefited from your books and your presentations. Regard the events that we've shared together as things I'll tell my grandchildren about. I have a Bible, a Scofield Bible that you've signed for me. Yeah, always amused. People come up to me and ask me to sign their Bibles, and I'm always embarrassed because I had nothing to do with it. In the Bible that I carry, you did, because you were one of the editors of the Scofield, and
I tell people when they go to heaven, if they have any trouble, just show them my signature.
Well, my
catch is, of course, they're not going to be able to take their Bibles with them.
Yeah, my favorite story of yours is when you shared with me what your hope is, that when you plan that as soon as right after the rapture, is to hold a class in remedial eschatology.
Yeah, I think that's my job up in heaven.
And then you usually quip and says, but you won't enjoy it because you have lost your sin nature. See, I want to point out to you, I listen carefully, John.
Well, you did a good job.
So, John, I really appreciate, on behalf of our listeners and the people that we have the opportunity to share you with, that we certainly extend our gratitude. And we appreciate your diligence and scholarship and tenacity through the years to
Well, I love the doctrine of the rapture, but most of all because I love the Savior. Can you imagine anything more thrilling than to see him face to face? I can't. And the wonderful fact is it could still be today. And those things are my arresting thoughts when it comes to prophecy.
Well, God bless you, my friend, and I sure appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
For a complete listing of materials to further enhance your personal Bible study, or to receive a free one-year subscription to Chuck Missler's monthly Christian Intelligence News Journal, Personal Update, contact Koinonia House at 1-800-KHOUSE1. That's 1-800-KHOUSE1. Or you can write to Koinonia House at P.O. Box D, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 83816-0347. To fax your correspondence, dial 208-773-6312.